Would you introduce yourself, please?
Jordan Zadorozny.
And now, but that's great. Now, there's some other name you're associated with, I believe.
My band, Blinker the Star.
Oh, yeah, that. So this has been going on for, I'm guessing about, as a thing, it's been going on for about 2 decades, approximately, right? We know that now, where exactly is, how far from where we are at this moment is Pembroke?
It's about 3 or 4 hours north.
Ah, so then you didn't grow up in the big city.
Not at all. No, small town boy.
The bio goes straight to, in 1993, he made his first record, and then there was a big label, which we'll sneak around to, and all that other stuff. But give me some between-the-line stuff, because the bios always miss a lot of things that really inform the music. And by the way, you're allowed to lie if you want to.
I think that, unlike most bands, I didn't really have dreams of performing on big stages as much as performing in big studios. And so the whole thing was basically a studio-based project from the beginning. And so the doing shows seems like, I feel like a fish out of water doing shows. I don't like going to shows. I don't like touring. So this is a studio project that once in a while rears its head as a live project.
Seems to be that the people who love the studio really love the studio. Live performance is scary, either because it's just scary or even more so because it's hard to achieve all that wonderful stuff you do in the studio live.
I'm so fixated on the sound in the studio that, and I love the idea of like capturing lightning in a bottle, and I like the sense of permanence where if you know you've done something great, it's there permanently. And shows are just fleeting, they're gone, they don't particularly last at all. So I'm more into the permanent aspect of things. And I love the idea of like capturing lightning in a bottle, and I like the sense of permanence where if you know you've done something great, it's there permanently. And shows are just fleeting, they're gone, they don't particularly last at all. So the payback for a show seems to me infinitely less than the rewards of a great recording and a great record.
I love this quote, you know, and it's piled up so many times, and I'm just going to go down a dangerous road here, and I do it in the full announcer voice. Blinker the Star, Canadian indie rock veterans. Da-da-da-da-da. So let's start with Canadian indie rock. I don't even know anymore what indie rock is. I don't even know, would Canadian indie rock, I would say that I would have to go for New Pornographers, you know, and all the arts and crafts bands. You know, if I was going to go Canadian indie rock, I'd go Broken Social Scene and New Pornographers. So I don't see you as Canadian indie rock, do you?
No, definitely not. As soon as I got out to Los Angeles when I was 23, I very quickly, hanging out in studios, realized that that's, you know, where I wanted to be. And the idea of Jeff Lynne and Todd Rundgren became more the ideal, as opposed to, I mean, what were the Canadian indie rock bands when I was sort of coming up, were Rio Statics perhaps, and 13 Engines. I don't know what Canadian indie rock is. I don't know what indie rock is either, but there is something different between Canadian and American rock music. And I've talked about this with my friend, and the one thing that I can identify is that there's less of a sense of danger in Canadian indie music and more of a sense of danger in the States, because I think that the safety net, the social safety net up here sort of protects people, and you don't get these smart, you know, bellicose kids from the underclass as much as you do in the States, where you get these kids from the bad neighborhood but that are intensely creative, and they make more extreme music or more challenging music than they would in Canada, just because it's a little safer and friendlier up here. When you see a respected Canadian artist and it says paid for by the government of Canada in the bottom right of the packaging, you don't really see that in the USA.
You know, the American government does not pay for anything.
No.
No. I mean, they pay for some recorded music, but not in this methodology.
No, and I guess I've sort of always kind of tried, or maybe not even consciously tried, but have stayed out of, you know, the Canadian club or the funding club. I've kind of just felt always pretty fiercely independent, and I've never really felt Canadian. I guess maybe because my formative, you know, studio years were spent in the States, where there's a much more, I don't know, sort of, at least in LA, there's a really rich, you know, recording and musical recording culture. So that informed me more than CanCon.
I guess what's interesting to me is you did you have a bad parting with that David Geffen-esque thing, or was it more just kind of like the classic that you served an album that they just weren't up for?
They were completely up for the record. The problem, I mean, I was on A&M first and then got sort of transferred to DreamWorks when Seagram's bought out Universal. I was one of the few bands that just didn't get outright dropped. I was sort of just, my contract was bought out by DreamWorks. And no, leaving the label was, it made perfect sense at the time. I'd made August Everywhere, which they were really behind. They spent a lot of money on promotion. It didn't click. And they were so behind the record that they encouraged me to go in the studio and make August Everywhere Part 2 with the same team, write the same kind of material. Let's give it another go. And my instincts were to change gears, and I ended up spending a year demoing and confusing the label. And at that point, I think it was about 2000, things were not looking great for DreamWorks either. And there was a feeling that they might not last too long, and maybe they were kind of getting confused by my experiments with different producers and stuff. And so they were nice enough, they didn't have to. They gave me the rest of my recording budget and dropped me politely. I mean, they asked me, they said, do you want to do this? I said, well, yeah, I can build my own studio, make my own record, and find somebody else to put it out, as opposed to going through another 2 or 3 years of protracted demoing. So they were nice, and they gave me a nice amount of cash, and I was able to start my own studio at that point.
9 years between, not the late, because there's been, now suddenly it's kind of like 9 years and then massive output, right? It's like nothing, and when I say nothing, we're going to circle back to the nothing, because I know nothing is not nothing.
Yeah.
Boy, all those degrees and I just said that. But
they're known unknowns.
But they're known unknowns. But 9 years and then 2 albums in 2 years. So that's pretty impressive. But now, during that 9 years, you had some label decisions to make, too. And also, that 9 years was a massive sea change in how records are put out. So when you emerged after that 9 years and said, okay, I'm going to put out these 2 records.
Yeah, 9 years went by pretty quickly. After I put out an independent album in 2003 called Still in Rome, that I ended up losing a bunch of money on, and was a bit discouraged after it, and decided to kind of, I'd had a small hit producing this guy named Sam Roberts up here in 2000.
You've been on the show.
Yeah, so when the Still in Rome album didn't do well, I was back at my studio, and the Sam Roberts thing was on the radio, so bands started coming up and checking me out and coming up to the studio. That's when I decided to really just focus on producing, and you know, there was bands steadily coming in, and I was able to support myself, and so I just kind of got really involved in that, and didn't. I was still creating music, and I actually put out 3 albums in the last year. There was one called Abby that I did with my friend Sophia, and that was my main creative vehicle in sort of the wilderness years in there when nothing came out. And that band broke up before I decided to put out more Blink of the Star stuff. And as I was just about to put out the Blink of the Star stuff, Sophia called me up and said, why don't we just put it out on the internet, put the album out. And so I put it out the day before the Blinker album came out, just in a rush, and just threw it out. So
when a band kind of disappears for 9 years, right, and then comes back, what's the kind of communication that you got from people who were like, oh no, Blinker the Star has broken up? And it's like, well, no, I haven't broken up with myself.
That's exactly it. You can't break up with yourself. So it was just me waiting for the right time. I think, so much had changed with how records are put out, and it became so much easier to put out your own records in the last couple of years, and perhaps just hire a publicist, and you can, you know, maybe get a little bit of, make a, some waves in that way.
This is kind of an interesting quote, that you worked in virtual isolation. And that's always a working with yourself sort of thing. But you brought other people into the studio to kind of... Now, did you bring them in the studio because you just wanted them to play? Or did you bring them in the studio because you also wanted to bounce and say, hey, what do you think of this?
I brought in people when I had an idea that I liked that I couldn't finish on my own. And so that's when I brought in people that could either help me co-write or play a few things. And people that I've worked with and known for a long time. I didn't really work with new people. It was people that had been in my musical family for a while.
But you also, in the bio, you speak of imaginary guests. Mm-hmm. You know, and you refer to some things that are warm to my heart, because when you refer to a Sandy Denny, 90% of the world probably is like, Sandy who? But they hear Sandy Denny on at least one of my shows. Right. And then you refer to Looking Glass, which I still play off the original. I have the original, you know, 45 from back in the day. But talk to me about being I'm trying to think of a polite word, as definitive about what a sound should be.
The sound almost comes first. The way I work is I begin recording the finished version of the song right away, even though it's not written yet. I start, and sometimes I'll just have a verse that I'll work on for 2 weeks. And what I do is, because I've been listening to records since I was 3 years old, I'm able to sort of cull sound images from my head and sort of work them into the project. And so, you know, if I'm thinking about Sandy Denny for a second, no one would ever spot the influence on my records, because they don't sound particularly Celtic or folky, but there will be, a particular haunting reverb that's in my head from a particular Sandy Denny song that I'll try to achieve on a backing vocal, and there's that little piece of the puzzle. So sound really is as important to me as song.
So tell me about the studio, because I don't think my listeners know.
Well, I have a studio after the DreamWorks deal ended. As I said, they gave me some money, and I moved back to my hometown where I grew up and built a really nice, comfortable, big studio where it's residential, it's in a small town. So when bands come up, they really leave their lives behind them and are able to really focus, because there's nothing to do in Pembroke. I mean, there's the country karaoke bar down the street.
Ooh, I want to come visit that.
And a French creperie right below me, which makes beautiful crepes. So that there's two good things besides my studio there.
20 more years from now, and we're sitting there and you go, you know, I never had the elusive hit, right? The hit song. But if anybody knows how to write, underline how to write a hit song, I would say you would be in that place. So writing a hit song for somebody else, producing a great record for somebody else, and then doing it for yourself, would you say that part of the reason you work in isolation is because, you know, you want the hit song, but in the end, what you really want to do is just do what you're doing?
I've tried to write hit songs in the past, and they never work out. They never turn into hits. The feeling I get is halfway through the process is that I've painted myself into a corner, and I can't get out without walking on the paint. Whereas if I'm working in a more sort of fluid and intuitive way, which I now only work that way, things just come more naturally, and they end up sounding more like hits to me anyway, because I'm not focusing on it, and my love of pop music is just in my DNA anyway. I have a friend, I used to say when I, you know, 15 years ago when I was more cocky, I used to, you know, bitch about stuff that was on the radio and tell my friend that I could write, and he said, I actually don't think you can. I think that you could get close in the process, but there's something in your musical DNA that makes you shy away from that big embarrassing moment that everyone loves. Yeah, the obvious thing that I shy away from. I think that if I ever were to have a hit, it would be a co-write with somebody whose instincts are a little bit more straight. And I present maybe, what I often do is present an instrumental to singers and then just have them sing over this finished piece of music. They don't hear all the work that went into it. They just hear a chunk of music that they can sing over. I get stymied because I can hear everything that I've put into it, and I'm not sure where to go.
So you think you're keeping yourself from that hit?
Perhaps, unfortunately.
But yeah, with such an amazing library in your head of pop music. It's kind of amazing. But maybe you're trying to take all those pop songs that you love and better them.
Yes, I am. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And I also tend, I think, one of the self-defeating things as far as having a hit for me is that I do tend to be attracted to less literal pieces of music, and not just musically, but lyrically. I tend to be attracted, and songs that are less literal lyrically have less of a chance, I think, with resonating with people emotionally.
So when you're here at an NXNE, and you are going to be playing on, you know, you're going to be playing at the legendary Horseshoe Tavern, you know, and the place will probably be packed tonight. And then you're going to be playing, you know, on a big stage before big bands. Is that all in the long run? Is that equally good to going on the worldwide tour, you know, and being, you know, the lead act? Is that all good? Are you happy with that?
That would be fun because it would be, if there were a big tour, it would mean that there would be a reason to tour, and therefore it would be fun to do. But to struggle on an indie rock tour in the van is not going to happen.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. Okay. And it's two of your songs as the bread. Okay. And then songs by anybody else you want to play in between. And it's 40 minutes of solid music